It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferrich. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, our guest says there's a lot more overlap between the worlds of religion and science than people might think. First, President Trump delivered his first State of the Union address last night to a joint session of Congress. He pointed toward economic gains over the last year and said that the country is seeing a time of opportunity for everyone.
This, in fact, is our new American moment. There has never been a better time to start living the American dream. So to every citizen watching at home tonight, no matter where you've been or where you've come from, this is your time.
The president went on to call for Congress to pass a new infrastructure plan, overhaul the nation's immigration system, and modernize America's nuclear weapons. We want to know what stood out to you at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with the president that the State of the Union is stronger than it was a year ago? What issue do you think we'll most likely see progress on in the coming year? Was there something you were looking for in the speech that you did not hear? Email ideas@WPR.org or call in at 800-642-1234. Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She researches the American presidency, political parties, and political rhetoric. Julia, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, before we get to the content of the speech, Julia, people wonder, does the State of the Union matter? Is this something worth tuning into? You wrote a piece on 538 saying, yeah, it is. Tell us about it.
So I think that there's, one of the things I really like about the State of the Union compared with other types of speeches, particularly an Oval Office address, is that you actually do get to see Congress. You get to see Congress reacting and responding, and you see that you kind of are reminded of all the different people that are involved in the national lawmaking process and not just the president making proclamations. I also think the State of the Union, so I admit I was grumbling last night when he went into four pillars at 9 o'clock, an hour into the speech, our time. Yeah, I was ready to go to bed, but I like that it's a longer speech because it gives presidents an opportunity to talk about the themes that tie together their agenda. And, they do this in different ways, and some arguably are more effective than others. And obviously, depending on where people stand, they might have very strong responses in favor or against the content of those themes. But I think that's really important in a democracy is not just a thing about the nitty-gritty of each individual policy issue, but to really think about what's the broader idea and significance of each part of this agenda.
We heard leading up to the speech that President Trump would push for bipartisanship. Here's a listen to a little bit of his call for that near the beginning of the address.
But it is not enough to come together only in times of tragedy. Tonight, I call upon all of us to set aside our differences, to seek out common ground, and to summon the unity we need to deliver for the people.
So in his policy parts of his speech and the symbolic parts of the speech, did you hear the president continue that theme?
So are you talking about the
Of bipartisanship working together, yeah.
Yeah, a little bit. I've been reading some of the reactions the next day, and there seems to be these, two very different reactions to the domestic policy substance. One suggests that there are a number of things on the table for Democrats to like, including an infrastructure bill. And then there's the other perspective that essentially says, regardless of what's being offered here, the tension of the moment is not going to allow for a lot of bipartisanship, and the kinds of symbolic language that Trump used throughout the speech is really going to turn off Democratic voters. And then if that's the case, then Democratic lawmakers don't have a lot of incentive to cooperate with the president.
And the president talked about good news in the economy over the last year, unemployment down, stock market up, African-American and Hispanic-American unemployment at record lows. The argument since then seems to be how much credit does President Trump get to take versus continuing past trends? How do you split that difference?
I guess the way I split that difference is that when it comes to election time, the president is going to take responsibility for the current state of the economy, regardless of how much it may have been a group effort, which is almost always, right? the structural factors in the economy that lead to any particular set of outcomes are very longstanding. But that's, you know, when it comes to be 2020, if the economy's good, then Trump will get credit for that. And if it's not good, then he'll be blamed. And I think, a version of that is also in effect in 2018. I will also say, though, this is important. People in political science and in data journalism, people who pay attention to numbers and to trends, have noted that Trump is much less popular. His approval ratings are much lower than you would expect, given the quality of the economy.
And why is that? Just the same things we've been talking about since the election?
I think that seems like the most obvious explanation, that we have a president who, if you look at his path to the presidency, and it's interesting to me that we can't have a conversation about Trump without it ultimately tying back to the election very quickly. This is a president who had a controversial path to the nomination and then a very divisive and intense general election campaign and ultimately lost the popular vote. That doesn't always matter a lot when it comes to approval, but it certainly doesn't help. And I think there are some elements, I think people in his own party have suggested that, you know, that some of his Twitter activities don't appeal to everybody, things like that. So, you know, that's, he holds some controversial views that he's stuck to over the course of his presidency. So I think that's an important part of the background of the story. I don't think we can just carve out the State of the Union and discuss it separately from that context.
We're talking to Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at the State of the Union address last night. Julia, immigration was something people were watching for. I think the president gave more detail about specific immigration plans than any other topic. I want to give a listen to the president talking about immigration, the DACA program, and referencing the program in a call for border security.
My duty and the sacred duty of every elected official in this chamber is to defend Americans, to protect their safety, their families, their communities, and their right to the American dream. Because Americans are dreamers too.
What did you make of that line in particular, Julia, before we get into the wider immigration debate?
Well, so in a little bit, I'm going to be teaching my American presidency class, and I'm going to give them some reactions from all across the spectrum. And so I've got one from the conservative end of the spectrum that said this was a terrific line, and that this was the best part of the address. I really hammered home his viewpoint, and then another viewpoint that says this is incredibly insulting. It's taking away the point that dreamers are trying to make about the threat that they feel. So I think that pretty much summarizes the two poles of the opinion about that line. On the one hand, Trump has had this really consistent America First kind of set of ideas that was a big part of his inauguration, and this speech reminded me much more of his inaugural address than of the address he gave to the joint session of Congress last year. So that's been, you know, is sort of not new to anybody. And yet at the same time, this has become a really forefront issue in a way that's fairly new to this era. Immigration is a central national point of debate. And those viewpoints are bothersome to a lot of people. And that stirs up a lot of controversy. And those will be key points, I think, used by opponents of the administration in the 2018 midterms, and then eventually looking ahead to 2020.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Madeline is with us in De Pere. Madeline, hi.
Hi. Yes, I heard a report that really alarmed me. And I heard today that the Dreamers, you know, everybody thinks the Dreamers are out picking strawberries. Well, they're going to college. Some of them have been to college. They have important jobs. And I heard that the Dreamers contribute over $40 billion a year toward Social Security and Medicare. And if they would suddenly leave, wouldn't that devastate Social Security and Medicare? And I'm talking as a elderly person.
Madeline, thanks for the call. Julia, I don't know if you have dug into that much detail on the Dreamers' impact on the economy, but in broad strokes anyway, what's at risk for the wider society if there's no deal reached on DACA?
Yeah, I think that the caller gets to an important issue. So I don't know. I am not an expert either in the labor market economics or really in immigration. So I don't know what the specifics. I think that it's unlikely that the impact of the Dreamers is so profound that if they were to leave, that it would collapse a major federal entitlement program. That seems unlikely. But what is likely, I think, and what is sort of the point of some of these debates about immigration that are not so much about who comes into the country or how, but about what to do with people who are already here, is that these folks are integrated into their communities. And so this is what I've heard from people who do have expertise in immigration, that these are folks who are sometimes they're married to U.S. citizens, their kids are U.S. citizens, and they're working jobs, and they're paying some taxes in different forms depending on their employment situation. And they're integrated into their communities, and so having them leave and taken from their communities would be, I think, disruptive. And I think that's something we can acknowledge, even though there's very strong feelings all across the ideological spectrum about immigration, is that when you propose to take people who are living here, and a large number of people, and have them leave, that has a kind of ripple effect on a broader community.
Thanks
and on the economy.
Thanks for the call, Madeline. We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at President Trump's first State of the Union address last night. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What is your reaction to the State of the Union address overall? Are there particular items within it that you liked or didn't like? Are there things that the president should have addressed but did not? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Julia Azari from Marquette University, looking at President Trump's State of the Union address last night. You can join in with your reactions at 800-642-1234, 800-642-1234. Did you like what you heard? Did you not? Did you avoid the speech altogether? What issues were you glad the president brought up? What did you like? What didn't you like in the speech? What was missing? 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One of the things some people saw missing, Julia, was talk about Russian interference in the U.S. elections and in other elections in Western Europe, for that matter, saying why didn't the president tackle those in his list of challenges facing the country? What are your thoughts?
So that's a really big one, and I know what I heard as I was listening to other public radio programs driving to work this morning. There clearly, there's a set of ideas that he didn't bring that up for the same reasons that people have suggested he's not enforcing the sanctions on Russia more harshly. So there's that interpretation. I think it's hard to know what he would have said that would have addressed his critics' concerns and made them feel better. He could have said anything, and I don't know that would have really meant that there was nothing going on behind the scenes. And for his supporters, who I think clearly were probably the more likely people to be watching the speech and who he was more trying to address, they don't really want to hear about that. One thing that seemed like it might be possible is that he would say more about how the investigation should end. We've seen enough of that. Nixon did a version of that in 1974, and we didn't really see that so much in so many words. So I honestly don't know what to make of it, or precisely what the speechwriters might have been thinking. But probably the smart strategy is when you have something like that you don't want to mention, and there's nothing you can say to win that issue, that downplaying it is a relatively low-risk strategy.
You mentioned earlier the infrastructure spending plan, something the president has talked about before, something that people see as maybe a bipartisan opportunity. Let's listen to a little of what he had to say.
Tonight, I'm calling on Congress to produce a bill that generates at least $1.5 trillion for the new infrastructure investment that our country so desperately needs. Every federal dollar should be leveraged by partnering with state and local governments and, where appropriate, tapping into private sector investment to permanently fix the infrastructure deficit. And we can do it.
Julia, what do you think? Is there room for cooperation in Congress on something like this?
I think there might have been last year. I think it's hard to imagine that going into a midterm. And I think the politics of that are going to be challenging. It's tempting to think that what the kinds of legislation that's really likely to happen is the kind where you can carve out a middle ground between the two parties and you can kind of get some people from each party who are excited about that legislation, or at least are sort of in favor of it. But I think that's going to be a really tricky one, because I can't think of a core constituency in the Republican Party for whom this is going to be a central issue. It's something a lot of people care about, but unless it has a core, I hate to say it, but unless it has a core set of interest groups that are really pushing for it, I don't see there being the political energy in Congress. Now, I could be wrong about this. If people turned around, Republicans and Democrats, and wrote letters and called their representatives in droves and put a lot of political pressure for a bill, then obviously the political situation would be different. But the kinds of things that languish are the kinds of things that most people think are a good idea, but for no one is it their main core passionate issue.
Let's go back to our callers now. Patrick is on the line in eastern Wisconsin. Patrick, hi.
How you doing?
Good. What do you think?
I didn't watch it. And today, talking to people I probably talked to about 8 or 10, I only found one person that did watch it, and they didn't watch it, they taped it. And I didn't watch it because I don't see that it has much real importance to me. The State of the Union is going away to the old party platform and the planks, and it had meaning in the past, but I can't see that there's much linkage between any of these proposals and reality.
Patrick, thanks for the call. I didn't watch it myself. I listened to it on the WPR app. I'll get a little plug in there. But Julia, do you think a lot of people think like Patrick that it's kind of archaic, not really worth watching?
I do think that. I mean, I don't have hard numbers in front of me. So I watched it and I live blogged it on 538. I'll do my plug. I knew a lot of people who weren't watching it. I heard a lot of people who weren't watching it. And that was the case, too, I think, a couple years ago. So I don't think it's totally driven by however people might feel about Trump. I think the caller's comparison to party platforms is quite astute. And I think that that's right, that these things aren't the sorts of core documents that day-to-day a lot of people see as being relevant for their lives. But on the other hand, again, these organized interests still really make a strong effort to get their issue included in the State of the Union, to get their issue included in the platform. So a lot of elite power politics are still happening around these documents that ordinary people are not necessarily really attuned to. And I think I don't know what the solution to that is or what to do moving forward, but I would encourage everybody to really think about that.
Patrick, thanks for that call. We're talking to Julia Azari, Associate Professor of Political Science at Marquette University, looking at the State of the Union address. Back to your calls. Colin is with us in Dubuque. Colin, hi.
Hello, how are you doing?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, what I want to bring up is what Mr. Trump didn't bring up, which is anything relating to climate. All he brought up was this beautiful, clean-burning coal. That's fine. While the rest of the world, is worried about renewable resources. And even if he doesn't agree with it, why are we not, striving to be the leaders in, like, creating solar panels or turbines? And, we could lead the world in that, even if we don't want to use it here at home, or he doesn't want to use it here at home.
Colin, thanks for the call. Julia, mention of energy and fossil fuels in particular, not an environmental mention.
No, you did not hear that. So I want to take a step back and put this in context, which is to suggest that it did used to be that both the issues of the environment and that kind of relationship between the government and the scientific community used to be quite a bit more bipartisan than they are now, and now that's really changed. And again, going back to what are Trump's incentives to talk about these kinds of issues, Increasingly, the constituencies that he's responding to in the Republican Party are not ones that want to hear that message, and we see that reflected. And I think that that's, you know, it's concerning that there's not more more bipartisan effort to engage with these issues and come up with some solutions to the problems.
Colin, thanks for the call. Julia, as we start to wrap up, you mentioned earlier you saw commonalities, themes from President Trump's inaugural address where the phrase American carnage featured prominently and this first State of the Union. Can you talk about how you saw that tone carried through there?
Yeah, I was really struck by this by the end of the speech, that the thing that linked up the domestic portion of the speech and the foreign policy portion of the speech was this violence. And Trump talks fairly graphically and in detail about the violence that people have experienced in different ways. And so we had a number of crime victims. We talked about gang violence. We talked about terrorism. And we talked about the torture perpetrated by the North Korean government, and that this was many of the people who were highlighted with their stories. It was about violence, or in one case, it was a woman struggling with a drug addiction. So it was very, I thought these themes, it was interesting to me that people said this was an optimistic speech. Watching it in my living room, I came away with a very different kind of impression, that there were a lot of very dark themes that were underlying that weren't, you know, no one's going to write a line in the speech that says what ties us all together is the world is a cruel and violent place. But that was sort of how I felt at the end. So that was just kind of my reaction watching it from a rhetoric kind of perspective.
And briefly, Julia, you kind of touched on this earlier. Do you see this speech targeted more toward President Trump's already existing supporters than the country as a whole?
I think for sure most presidential rhetoric is often going to be targeted at their existing supporters rather than the country as a whole.
Julia, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
Julia Azari is an associate professor of political science at Marquette University. She joined us to look back at last night's State of the Union address. First, there's some easy contrasts that have been built up around religious and scientific communities. The short version is something like this: religious people don't like science, and scientific people don't like religion. But recent research took a closer look and found something that many scientific and religious people probably knew all along: you can be part of both worlds. Our next guest found that nearly half of evangelicals, for example, believe religion and science can have a collaborative relationship and support each other, but there are still some tensions between the two. Elaine Howard Eklund is the co-author of Religion Versus Science: What Religious People Really Think. She's also director of the Religion and Public Life Program and professor of sociology at Rice University. Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me, Rob.
Well, I want to go to the opening line in the main part of your book, quoting Richard Dawkins is not typical. We wish religious people knew this. Ken Ham is not typical. We wish scientists knew this. So Richard Dawkins, the biologist and prominent atheist, Ken Ham, the prominent creationist. Why did you open with that?
Well, Rob, when we surveyed religious people, we found that many of them did think that Richard Dawkins was typical of all scientists. And when we followed up with in-depth interviews with them, that became even more apparent to us. And in my broader research on scientists, I find that even for atheist scientists, there is not the sense that they're all against religion. So first of all, as you correctly stated when you did your opening, there are certainly people who have a foot in both worlds. So there are scientists who are religious, and there are religious people who are scientists, of course. But yet there are still these seemingly intractable myths about both communities. And so we wanted to set out to bring social science research to light on this.
And you did that by talking to people, for one thing, but with big surveys. What did you try to tackle over the course of your research in surveying people of various faiths and non-faiths?
So we wanted to know, first of all, we did a survey of over 10,000 people in the U.S., so everyone, all religious traditions, as well as the non-religious. We wanted to know what issues there really are tensions around. And we found that in general, people of faith really like science. And actually, I would say that I, as a researcher, even someone who studied religion for a number of years now, was a little bit surprised about how enthused people of faith are about science. And this means Jews and Christians and Muslims, the major traditions that are represented in the U.S., and even fairly conservative Christians, which I think sometimes have been the group that has been kind of pitted against science in the media and has raised some real concerns about, say, teaching evolution in public schools and things like that. So I was surprised at the extent to which religious people actually really like science. We have questions as social scientists about social distance on surveys. Like, for example, we might ask, would you like your child to marry a person of this social group or partner with a person in this social group? And that's a measure of affirmation of that group, right? You might be fine knowing someone, but having them come into your family is a different kind of thing. Well, across the board, Americans tend to think scientists are a pretty positive group of people, no problem with their children marrying them, for example. But we did find that certain scientific issues do cause concern among religious people. So issues that have to do, or at least people of faith think they have to do, with who God is and who humans are. So there's the sense that religious people want an involved God, and they want humans to be treated as sacred. So particular issues, so evolution is one of those issues that raises concerns about who God is. So did God really start the world and create human beings and sponsor their development, or is there something else that doesn't involve God? So there's concerns about evolution. There's concerns about the so-called beginning of life technologies, reproductive technologies, genetic testing, these kinds of science that seem to cause some people pause when it comes to the sacredness of human beings as distinct.
One of your goals in the book is to provide some lessons as to how people in the science world can talk to people in the faith world and vice versa. When you've got an issue like evolution, where at least a portion of a given faith community views it as wrong and contradictory to their teachings, is there a productive way for people on either side of that debate to get together and talk about it?
Rob, I'm a professor, so my go-to is getting people more information, right? And I would say one thing I learned from doing this research for the past 5 years is that it's not necessarily a matter of more information. So people of faith, many of them know what evolution is, would say, get that right on a test. But they just don't think it's right. They don't feel like it's right in terms of the kind of implications it might have for their faith traditions. And what does seem to change people's minds to some extent, social psychologists will tell us, is actually knowing someone who dispels your stereotypes. So if you're, say, an evangelical Christian, and you are to meet a scientist in your congregation who's also an evangelical Christian, who kind of challenges some of your stereotypes. You thought maybe all scientists were atheists, but this person is clearly a scientist, someone who, say, is in the worship band at your church and does kind of church things, and you trust them, and yet they also are an evolutionary biologist. That might kind of change your stereotypes a bit. And that relationship tie is a kind of tie that then maybe you're more susceptible to information being passed over that tie. And so scientists often ask me, you know, what kind of information do I need to give religious people to get them to think evolution's okay, to get them on board with human embryonic stem cell research? And it may not be just a matter of information. The first question may be something like, who do religious people trust? And what does it take to build their trust? That may be the better kind of question to ask.
Elaine Howard Eklund is with us, co-author of the new book, Religion Versus Science, What Religious People Really Think. And that gets to one of the myths that you are trying to bust in the book, the idea that religious people are not scientists, and I guess a corollary that scientists are not religious people. There's more overlap than we might think.
That's right. That's right. So we did find that there are definitely scientists in the faith communities that we studied. So we studied in depth Christians, including evangelical Christians, mainline Protestants like Methodists, Episcopalians, for example, Catholics. as well as Muslims and Jews in U.S. society. There are definitely scientists in each of those traditions, even scientists in who are evangelical Christians, which, as I said earlier, has been a tradition that's sometimes been pitted against science in more recent years. So there are scientists there. We found that they tended not to be scientists who were at elite research universities, and I wrote a different book called Science Versus Religion, What Scientists Really Think, a few years ago, and that took a look just at the top research universities in the U.S., and religious people, particularly conservative Christians, are a bit underrepresented in those kinds of institutions. But when you look into the general science profession, so if you include, say, medicine in that, you think about, you know, research and development for an oil and gas company or a pharmaceutical company, other kinds of scientific professions, they're pretty religiously similar to the general population. So there is about the same proportion, a little bit less, of, say, evangelical Christians, mainline Protestants in those professions as in the general population. But I don't think scientists, because of the prevalent stereotypes, always feel comfortable talking about their science at church, for example. And so maybe that's where there's some confusion, is that if you're kind of secretive about your work, then your peers, the other people in the pews, might not necessarily know that there are scientists in their congregations.
And you mentioned the issue of maybe people of a particular faith being suspicious of certain kinds of reproductive science and technology. And that seems like a little different issue. If you're arguing over the age of the earth or evolution, you're arguing about evidence and the nature of reality in some ways. If you're talking about reproductive technology, I mean, by analogy, if you're opposed to nuclear power, you're not disputing atomic theory. You're disputing the application of it. So is that a different kind of argument?
It is a different kind of argument. That was well put. So this is a set of science which has, scientists will tell you too, has a lot of ethical implications. And here is where the Christians and Muslims and Jews we interviewed. So we did this big survey, which I talked about earlier. We also followed up the survey with over 300 in-depth interviews in 23 different religious organizations. And we found, especially through our interviews, that people of faith wonder if scientists have reflected ethically as much as they need to. Just because it can be done, should it be done, was a question that religious people often posed to me when I was interviewing them. And so they wonder if, you know, scientists are doing all the ethical spade work they need to, and they wonder about the application. They also think that scientists may dislike them. And so there was another question on our survey, which was really interesting, Rob, where we asked religious people and non-religious people whether or not they perceive scientists to be hostile to religion. And we found that, especially amongst evangelicals, but also Catholics, mainline Protestants, there is a sense that maybe scientists are kind of hostile to religious people. I don't think that's actually accurate. In my broader work on scientists, I don't find that scientists are, by and large, hostile to religious people. They may not understand them always, but I didn't find this kind of hostility that religious people thinks is so prevalent. And so that shows that there may be a kind of misunderstanding. That's why we talk, Christopher Scheidel, the co-author of this book, and I talk so much in the book about moving beyond myths and stereotypes, because there may be some serious misunderstanding between these two communities. There may be more room for dialogue than we might think.
Elaine Howard Eklund is the director of the Religion and Public Life Program at Rice University, co-author of the book Religion Versus Science, What Religious People Really Think. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you find religion and science compatible or at odds with one another? If you're in the faith world, are you suspicious of some of what the scientific world teaches, or vice versa? Or do you live in both worlds and you're doing just fine? Thank you very much. You can join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also tweet us at Central Time WPR. We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We pick up our conversation now with Elaine Howard Eklund, author of the book Religion Versus Science, What Religious People Really Think. We're looking at how religious people view science and if they see it as compatible with their faith. You can join in at 800-642-1234 or email ideas@wpr.org. Do you have feet in both worlds, religion and science, or do you see a conflict between the two? Do you see yourself on one side of that conflict? Call 800-642-1234 or tweet us at Central Time WPR. To your calls now. Susanna is with us in Milwaukee. Susanna, hi.
Hi.
What do you think?
Well, I was raised in a very conservative evangelical Christian home, went to Christian school where we were taught creationism primarily. And I recently married a microbiologist who serves as a Sunday school teacher at my church and I serve at church as well. So I know that even though I was raised believing that evolution was not at all compatible with Christianity, as I've grown up and met my husband and had conversations, I've found that, yes, they are compatible and you can actually be in both worlds.
Susanna, thank you so much for sharing your story. Elaine, what do you think?
I think Susanna's story is probably not that typical. We did find in our broader research that sometimes an experience like Susanna's might cause her to chuck her faith altogether. And, you know, when she's exposed to science. And so I think within her words, there's a nice lesson. Maybe there's youth group ministers out there listening to the show. We need to teach children, you know, how to ask hard questions of their faith in the context of churches, say, and synagogues and mosques. And so I think it's neat that now Susanna has this, you know, marriage where she's being exposed to these kinds of ideas, and that her husband obviously doesn't think that there's any personal conflict. The second kind of thing is I wonder if the microbiologist's husband is talking about his science at church, and, you know, there would be a lot of people who might be interested in finding kind of inspiration in that if he did.
Susanna, thanks a lot for the call. We heard from Linda on Facebook. Linda says, science increases my faith. For example, who could possibly make a fully functioning digestive system in something so small as a gnat? Wonder, she writes, is all around us. We need to respond to it. We need to look at it, see it, and we need to take the time to learn about it. And Linda reminds me of, I think, Isaac Newton, right? I mean, a big science figure, and he viewed himself as exploring God's creation in some ways.
Mm-hmm. There is a rich history in the Christian tradition of scientists who thought that they were, you know, exploring God's creation, and their faith gave them a kind of motivation to learn more about science. And scientists, it's funny to me when I interview and survey scientists themselves, they don't feel like free to talk about that openly, but they're certainly there in modern day times too, meaning that there are scientists who are people of faith and who, for whom their faith tradition kind of is a motivating factor. They don't see it as in any way in conflict. And in particular, scientists who have faith tell us that they use their faith to think through these kind of potentially sticky ethical issues. So they don't think that, you know, being a person of faith necessarily changes their scientific work in any way. They're doing the same science as those people who don't have faith, but their faith traditions might give them a rich narrative or way of thinking about the application of their scientific work in ways that's generative.
Talking to Elaine Howard Eklund, co-author of Religion Versus Science, What Religious People Really Think. Back to your calls now. Bob is with us in the Madison area. Bob, hi.
Hi. I was just seeing that my son, he has Asperger's, and he did not accept our faith. We were born and raised Catholic, which caused me to take a look at my Catholic faith, and I started reading all these books on science, and about 15 to 20 books later, I began to understand his point, and the conclusion that I've come to is that truth will be truth regardless of if it's in the science field or within the religious field. And I basically concluded that all religions have evolved like culture and language over time, and it's our understanding of how we have tried to understand the mysteries that are before us. Science is pretty much trying to do the same thing, but they're trying to do it through observation. And I find that science actually points to the designer and a creator. And with that, I'll let you comment on that and leave the call.
Bob, thanks for the call. Elaine, does that sound like stories you heard in talking to people as part of your research?
It does. I think, Bob, our caller really does, has, you know, thought about this in a pretty articulate way, and some scientists are not able to really articulate that in the same way. They don't really have space in their lives to think about how science and faith fit or don't fit together. And so sometimes even doing an interview provides a kind of space for reflection. But that narrative does come up, if I understand it correctly, that science is discovering truth about the natural world using a particular set of tools and methods, and that religion discovers other kinds of truth. This sort of, there's a kind of Stephen Jay Gould, the famous paleontologist who coined the term non-overlapping magisterium, that science and faith are different kinds of knowledge and in independent realms. I think that's a really interesting approach. Scientists do say that in practice it sometimes gets hard because, you know, religious people bring up sticky issues for science. So then faith kind of enters science, right? It's hard to keep them separate. And so the independence framework, or that they're non-overlapping, can only go so far in how you actually live your life. But the caller certainly raises a great point, and something which I've heard among the scientists I've interviewed.
Elaine, you find a fair amount of common ground and places where people can reach past stereotypes to bring together people of faith and science, sometimes in the same person. But are we always going to be stuck with areas of conflict? I'm thinking of the debate over how evolution is taught in schools, if evolution is taught in schools, if alternatives have to be taught. I mean, we're going back about a century, and it's still a lively debate. How do we get around that? How do we work with that?
I don't want to come off as sounding overly Pollyanna-ish. There are real conflicts. I'll add another one to the one that you just nicely stated, Rob. So we asked the people in our survey to what extent they think scientists ought to entertain miracles in their theories and explanations for how the world works. And, you know, even scientists who are people of faith think that miracles are something separate. They might believe they exist, but they don't think that what they're doing as scientists should necessarily involve miracles or have access to miracles. Yet, you know, 60% of evangelical Christians think scientists ought to entertain miracles as part of their theories and explanations about the world. And so when religious groups say that there's the potential for collaboration between science and religion, the next question I need to ask myself as a researcher is, what kind of science are they talking about and what kind of religion? Because it does seem like these two bodies of knowledge make sometimes contradictory claims about the way that the world works. And so, but I do come down on the side of understanding that yes, there are those issues in the corners which are lurking, but there's so much misunderstanding. Why not deal with that first, right? Then we can get to the really tricky stuff, but we're not even at the point where we've dispelled major stereotypes. So let's start there, and hopefully by starting to dispel stereotypes, we can gain some common ground for the common good. So, for example, if scientists knew just how on board that religious people are likely to be about environmental care, they might see some willing partners. That our research showed that objection to humans being involved in climate change, for example, research that shows this is really more of a political issue than a religious issue.
And we'll leave it there. Elaine Howard Eklund is the director of the Religion and Public Life Program and professor of sociology at Rice University. She's the co-author of the new book, Religion Versus Science, What Religious People Really Think. Still time to share your thoughts and maybe your own story. You can do that over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. There's a hot new book on the market from a Japanese publishing house. It sold out almost immediately on Amazon in its first print run. I just started reading it earlier today. It really grabs you right from the start. If it's okay, I'm going to read the opening lines. 467-333. 1-833-5923. 109-99-883. It goes on like that for 791 pages. It's not the phone book, remember those, or a secret code. The book title is The Biggest Prime Number in 2017. It's the printing of a number that we talked about a couple weeks back on Central Time, the largest known so far, largest known prime number discovered in a crowdsourcing project late last month. The number is over 23 million digits long, which is why it takes almost 800 pages to print it. The print run of the book is a little smaller. It's just 1,500 copies or so. But the fact remains, at least 1,500 people bought a copy of that book, and I'm wondering, I mean, is it a conversation starter? You leave it on the coffee table? Do you use it to generate random numbers from your for your role-playing game? Does it help you fall asleep at night? I think I'm not going to pre-order the second printing, but maybe you want to. This is Central Time here on the Ideas Network.